Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
The Astros, as I mentioned, finally did get around to meeting with the media to discuss the sign-stealing scandal. Did not go especially well. It did not go especially well, especially for the owner. Let's start with the players. Alex Bregman and Jose Altuve spoke briefly. Let me start with Bregman.
I have some brief remarks that I'd like to share with y'all. I'm really sorry about the choices that were made by my team, by the organization, and by me. I've learned from this, and I hope to regain the trust of baseball fans. I would also like to thank the Astros fans for all of their support. We as a team are totally focused on moving forward to the 2020 season. Thank you.
That's Bregman. Here is Altuve.
Thank you, Jimmy, and thank you, Alex. I also will be brief. We had a great team meeting last night, and I want to say that the whole Astros organization and the team feel bad about what happened in 2017. We especially feel remorse for the impact in our fans and the game of baseball, and our team is determined to move forward, to play with intensity, and to bring back a championship to Houston in 2020. Thank you.
And to stop cheating. That's what we talk about, right? Accountability, responsibility, ownership. Those statements were an improvement over what's been said in the past. And according to ESPN's Marley Rivera, Bregman and other Astros went even further in owning what happened and pushing back on this notion that Alex Cora and Carlos Beltran ran the entire thing. Yuli Gurriel said, quote, "No one put a gun to our head. It would be a lie to say that one or two people are responsible. We are all responsible," end quote. George Springer said, quote, "We are all responsible. Carlos and Alex were great to us." Bregman, quote, "No one put us up to this. We did it, all of us. Not one person made us do anything." And then Carlos Correa went even further.
I was the leader of the clubhouse. The thing I have a problem with is when I read that report is that we were scared of him or we felt intimidated. We didn't feel scared of Beltran. We didn't feel intimidated. He was the nicest guy that we could ever have. He was the best teammate we've ever had. Beltran was a leader of the clubhouse, but we all had a say in everything that we were doing in there. And, you know, whatever he said and whatever we were doing, we had the chance to stop it as a team. Everybody had the chance to say something, and we didn't. So whoever the anonymous source is that's saying that we felt intimidated or we were too young to say something, that's just straight up bull****. Beltran didn't intimidate nobody. Beltran's the nicest guy. And I know in Puerto Rican people will say, oh, he's just trying to protect him, but you can talk to every single guy here that was in 2017. Beltran is an unbelievable gentleman. He's a straight up gentleman, and nobody, not even you guys, nobody will feel intimidated by his presence, by his leadership, and whatever he has to say. He showed us how to play baseball hard. He was a veteran. He was inspiring. Whenever we were slumping, he was there for us. So I don't see a person that's your mentor and it's there for you when you're struggling as an intimidating person. So
he made that pretty clear. To quote Correa, the reports that Beltran intimidated them into cheating was straight up, quote, bull bleep. In other words, the players are acknowledging that they actively participated in it. They could have stopped it. They didn't. That's the kind of ownership that I'm looking for. That's the kind of ownership that I can respect. Unfortunately, the actual Astros ownership does not quite see it that way. Jim Crane did not do a good job today. Not at all. He had weeks to prepare for this, and yet he still tripped all over himself when he said things like this.
you know, our opinion is, you know, that this didn't impact the game. We had a good team. We won the World Series, and we'll leave it at that.
Really? Respectfully, Jim, that's bullcrap. It's horse mess. Yeah, I get that you don't want to give back the 2017 World Series, but saying that the scheme did not impact the game is ridiculous. If it didn't matter and it didn't help, why the hell were you doing it? Let me help you with that. Because it did matter and it did help. Reminds me of all that bullcrap that came out during the Roid era. You know, bullcrap like you can't just pull a guy off the streets, shoot him full of bullroids, and think that he can hit major league pitching. That to me was always the worst argument ever because nobody ever said that. Roids obviously helped, or guys would not have been geeked out of their minds on roids. Just like cheating by stealing signs actually helps. If it didn't impact the game, guys would not be doing it. Guys don't bang on trash cans if it doesn't help them hit baseballs. There is no point. Guys aren't turning the dugout into a performance of stomp just for the hell of it. If you want to argue that other teams are doing similar things, so your advantage was not that big, that's something different. But if you want to do that, you better come with the evidence about all the other teams. Otherwise, you're going to sound ridiculous. And he had other weird statements. Statements like, quote, "I don't think I should be held accountable," end quote. Well, you want to talk about somebody leading from the front. My team, my organization, I'm responsible for everybody and everything in it, right? Yeah, apparently not. Apparently, ain't my fault. I didn't know what the hell they were doing. I didn't know what the hell any of them were doing. Yeah, I'm going to call bullcrap on that too. And if you didn't know, you should have known you own the freaking team. But he wasn't done. Then he gassed up that 18-wheeler and he ran it right over AJ Hinch, Jeff Luno, Alex Cora, Carlos Beltran, and the players. He said the players, I should say the leadership, but he said the players, no, the players themselves were not at fault. Quote, "These are a great group of guys who did not receive proper guidance from their leaders," end quote. Except for one thing, Jimbo. To quote MLB's report, the 2017 scheme was, with the exception of Cora, player-driven and player-executed, end quote. So to put it all on the leadership and say that these are all great players and it had nothing to do with them is absurd. And even if Crane wanted to roll out with that defense, why were players at the press conference owning it and apologizing for it? And why were the players telling anybody in the clubhouse today that it was their responsibility? Why are the players owning it more than the owner? And then what was the deal with this exchange with Marley Rivera?
Jim, sign stealing is a distinct advantage for the hitter. So how is it that it doesn't affect competition? So then what are you guys apologizing for?
We're apologizing because we broke the rules.
But isn't sign stealing a distinct advantage for the hitter, so doesn't it automatically impact competition?
It could possibly do that. It could possibly not.
Okay, guys, we're going to wrap up. Thank you, Dustin.
So when did Jim Tomsula bite the Astros?
I would not say that. I wouldn't say it either. I would not say that.
The guy literally went Tomsula. Hey, Jim, don't you hate it when a reporter does their job and asks you a good question and you have a really bad answer? That made no sense. That made no sense. You got caught. Apologize for it. Own it. It's not a hell of a lot to ask. But to sit there and apologize for something, but say that that something didn't really matter is not an apology. You had all this time to prepare for this press conference, and that's what you came up with. Yeah, compare that response to even more from Correa.
So, I'm going to be honest with you. When we first started doing it, it almost felt like it was like an advantage. Everybody was using technology, so it felt like an advantage. But it was definitely wrong. It was definitely wrong, and we should have stopped it at the time.
You knew it was wrong?
Yeah, it was wrong. It was wrong.
At the time, you knew it?
Yeah, it was wrong. It was wrong.
And so what is the message outside of baseball when people in everyday life say, well, they cheated and seemingly got away with it. I should cheat in life. I can win,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's what we're here today, to tell everybody that it's not right to do that. you don't want to be standing here and, you know, having to do this because of that. You don't want to be remembered as that type of person. So that's what we're here talking to you guys today and telling you guys that what we did was really wrong. It's not going to happen again. We're going to play baseball the right way. But no, I don't want my kids. I don't want my brother. I don't want my family members, people that follow me, to think that I was right. That to cheat, to be successful is not right. So what we can do now as players is focus on what we can control from now on, and make sure we show everybody that we're good players, and the players that work hard every single day.
So that's how you handle that. We did it. It was wrong. We're sorry. It will never happen again. Pretty easy stuff, Jim. That's how you handle it. You acknowledge what happened. You acknowledge what you did. You acknowledge that it was wrong. You know it leaves a mark. You want to be better. It will never happen again. And I know I've played quite a bit of sound from Correa, but he said, quote, "I don't want my kids. I don't want my brother. I don't want my family members or people who follow me to think that it was right to cheat to be successful. What we did in 2017 was terrible. We all know it. We feel really bad about it," end quote. Now you compare that with everything Crane just said, and you realize how terribly that went for Crane. And because of that, it's going to linger even longer until Crane can get it right. Hey, Jim, you're not going to get beyond this until you own this. And even then, plenty are still going to think that you cheated. But don't take my word for it. Just ask the Cheatriots.
We had a good team. We won the World Series, and we'll leave it at that.
That's incredible. Oh, we'll leave it at that. Oh, okay, Jim. If you say so, we had a good team. We won the World Series, and we'll leave it at that. It's got to be one of the worst responses ever. All this time to come up with something. Ownership, accountability, to get ready for a presser, and that's what you come up with. The owner of the franchise. We had a good team. We won the World Series. I think I'll leave it at that. Oh, okay.
This didn't impact the game.
Yeah, not at all. Head coach John Cooper is my guest. John, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm great, actually. It's been a fun little ride we're on here, I think. Pretty excited about tonight, but thanks for having me back on your show.
It's good to have you. Yeah, it's good to have you back, John. I appreciate that. You know, talking about that ride, you're coming off a 2-1 overtime win on Pittsburgh Tuesday night. Let me start right there. Nikita Kucherov had to leave early with an injury. You were already without Steven Stamkos, but the team kept rolling right on to its eighth straight win. So when you're in the middle of a run like that, how much confidence does the team have that every time it takes the ice, it's going to find a way to win no matter what?
Well, to be honest, it's very similar. Like, we're kind of in a stretch right now, which is where we had, where we were last year, where you just, you come to the rink and you just feel like you're up 1-0 all the time. And before you even hit the ice. The difference being, though, I think there was a lot of times last year, like, we left the game thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe we got a point out of that, or we got 2 points. We didn't really deserve them. Where this year, we're walking out of there thinking, you know what, we deserve those points. Like, we played well enough to win that game. We had some guys out, but we were on the doing all the right things, and we're getting rewarded for it. And so, you know, we're seeing results that we feel, you know, earlier in the year when we weren't getting those point totals, but we were playing pretty well, and now we're seeing those results, and it's been a great little run we're on.
We're talking to John Cooper. In fact, it's more than the little run. You've won 20 of your last 23 games. So you mentioned the start of the year. What's been the biggest difference between the start of the season and everything since, say, late December?
All mentality. And I say this about our team. There was something about us. We had, like, an offensive arrogance to ourselves. And I think no longer, like, I look back to game one last year in Columbus, and we're up 3-0 in the first period, and you know, all of a sudden things are rolling and you're thinking, okay, this will be good. But instead of winning that game 3-0, we wanted to win it 8-0. And all of a sudden, you know, they get one, then they get another, and we're still pressing for goals. Next thing you know, we lose, and we lose 4 straight. And so one of the biggest things for us was to get over that mental barrier of saying, okay, yes, we love scoring goals. Do we love playing that way? We do. But if you want to advance, and it's that old cliche, defense wins championships, you need to be able to play D, and it's when you look out in the ice, it's not how many you put in the net, it's how many you keep out of your net. And so getting the team to, like, turn the corner, and it took some time to be able to break some habits and turn the puck over less, be a little bit more responsible, because, to be honest, it's not as fun. But in the end, you want to win, and you got to grind it out. And to train your team to play playoff hockey, you have to do it now, and that's what we've been doing.
John Cooper, my guest, I really, really respect that response. And to that point, you know, we're talking about how last season ended, and you've been pretty upfront about this. That's not the way you wanted the season to end, of course, but your message to the team was, quote, don't run, don't hide, man up. Look at what happened and come back stronger the next year. So what do you make of the way your guys have dealt with that shock and the pain of last year and the way they have come back?
Well, it's funny. We didn't play Columbus. You know, it was 10 months ago we lost that series. We played them for the first time this year, just a couple games ago. And that was really when the memories kind of stewed all the way back. You know, you have the feeling where you are in the locker room and the coach's room and all that stuff. But the one thing is, I think the fact that we hadn't played them in such a long time was good for us. We wanted to see where we stacked up against them. But again, it's just those barriers you have to break to decide if you want to be a championship team. And it's when you get to the playoffs, there's so many other things into it, health and bounces and all those things. But if you've got the guys training right, I remember, you know, when I met the great Bobby Knight, I met him like 15 years ago. He was such an awesome guy. But he said, I asked him, what one piece coaching advice would you give me? And he said, don't worry about the other team, worry about your team. And once you've trained your team to do what you want to do, they'll be all chasing you. And so I've always tried to kind of keep that in my head, and that's what we're trying to train our guys to do now.
We're talking to John Cooper. You know, John, back to that point you made that it's not about how many times you put the puck in the net, it's about how many times you keep the puck out of your own net. You talk about Andre Vasilevsky. He had 36 saves in that win over Pittsburgh. He's been on fire of late. Now, he talked about how he was not that pleased with the way he was playing earlier this season, and he said about changing that. What changes have you noticed from him, and how much does he mean to this team?
Well, he means, like, I look back, and or you look in sports, and I say, okay, well, football, you know, you've got the quarterback, probably most important guy on the field, and in hockey, you got the goalie, and they have such an impact on the game. And it's for Vassy, you know, we were kind of slowly turning our game around, and we'd give up last year, I'd say, 30, 35 shots a game, and he kind of relished it. Athletic goalie, liked the work. But when all of a sudden now you're giving up 18, 20, 22 shots, you go like 10 minutes without seeing one. He was actually struggling with that. And that's something that I think kind of goes overlooked in goaltending. Everybody says, well, you know, he's got all this athletic ability, but you know, a lot of times it's puts between the ears as well. And you have to train guys to, okay, what do you do during those 8 minutes where he hasn't seen a shot? And so our goalie coach, Franz Jean, has done a heck of a job. You know, like when there's TV timeouts, he used to sit in his crease. Now he leaves the crease. He skates around, and he's got him doing all these different things to keep himself engaged in games. And to be honest, ever since he's been doing those exercises, he's really taken off. So, you know, it's those kind of little things inside the game that, you know, you're trying to help your players out, and that's been a great thing for Vassy.
John Cooper joining me for another moment or so. So we talked about your room. We talked about your goaltender. We talked about your team. John, let me ask you to make it about yourself for a minute. When you and I spoke last season, in fact, we spoke a year ago to the day, we talked about your coaching style and how you approach your job, especially as it relates to the players. As the longest tenured coach now in the NHL, how much have you grown and changed since you first took over?
Oh, my gosh. Where do I start? I'll tell you one thing, and when I was in the American League, so I'm kind of coming up the ranks, and when I was in junior hockey before that, it was basically myself, an assistant. There was no such thing as having video guys. And even with the American League in 2012, when we won the Calder Cup, it was just I had one assistant coach, and I brought a video guy in. So the way things have changed now, you know, you got three assistant coaches. We have two video guys. Like, there's just so much more involved. I used to be such a hands-on guy. Like, I didn't have, I guess, the trust or what I needed to do to, I just took, I guess, what's that saying? You wear so many, do so many things good, but you don't do anything great. And I felt that for me to keep moving on, I had to trust in people. And so I found some great assistants, and I let them do their job. And I don't, you know, it's obviously, in the end, the decision's mine, but you have to find good people, and you got to let them do their job and give them freedom to work. And kind of, I just manage the whole situation just like I manage our team. And I've stepped away from the group. I don't talk to our group as much anymore. My voice is now probably a little bit more fresh being an older, kind of longer tenured guy, and it seems to be working out.
John Cooper joining us. I would say, you know, one last thought to that point. In fact, other coaches have talked about the dynamic between coaches and players and how much has changed over the years. You've made the point that in the past, that being a player's coach might have been something that was frowned upon because people thought that it meant you were just soft on players. But how much of being a player's coach is about constantly communicating and having a relationship with your players?
Yeah, there'll be people, I've heard the words partnership thrown around, and yeah, I guess in a way there is a partnership, but the relationship is key because, you know, like, I don't believe that the only thing you should be able to talk to a player is about, hey, how to take a faceoff or how to shoot a puck or where to go here. To get to know your players, like, you know, do they have a wife? How many kids do they have? Girlfriend, parents? Because to be honest, we spend 3 hours a day, 2 hours a day with them. There's 22 hours or whatever that they're doing something else. And I think for you to take a little time and care of what they do, and because what they do in those 22 hours affects what happens in the 2 or 3 hours you have them. And so, like I said, I'm not getting invited to these guys' weddings probably, but I think there's a respect value. And for us to take some time to get to know them, I think it makes the whole thing, just the synergy, it just makes it all better.
He is the longest tenured head coach in the NHL, seventh full season with the Lightning. He's the head coach there. They are in second in the Atlantic on a great run right now. To the day, John, it's been 1 year. It's great to have you back. I really appreciate the conversation. Thanks so much. Let's do it again.
Yep. See you in 365 days.
Is this the beef jerky segment?
Is this the beef jerky segment?
Signed Reese McGuire. It is. Come to find out. All right, so Toronto Blue Jays pitchers and catchers report today. However, one Jays catcher already reported on the police report. Hey-o! Pretty safe bet that if I'm talking about a Toronto Blue Jays catcher in February, that's not going to be for a good reason. If it's the backup catcher who played in only 30 games last year, you know homeboy jacked something up pretty badly. Because you might imagine I am not here to talk about Reese McGuire batting .299 with 5 home runs in 105 plate appearances last season. And I am not talking OPS. I am talking TMZ, as in the report from TMZ. Let me read the first sentence from the initial report. Quote, Toronto Blue Jays catcher Reese McGuire, a former MLB first-round pick, was arrested last week after cops say he was caught exposing his penis in a Florida parking lot. End quote. Let me stop right there. I think I probably should have hit you with a disclaimer. This next take is graphic in nature. Better late than never. That's a hell of a lead, isn't it? That is one hell of a lead. But you never want to jump to conclusions. I mean, there's nothing good at all about being caught in a Florida parking lot with your junk out. But you know me. I'm responsible. I never rush in. I never judge without getting all the necessary data. Even if there is a TMZ report about a police report referencing a dude exposing his penis, I still need more information. Before you get my reaction, I am not going to rush in. So I went looking for more information, and I found it. Quote, deputies were called to a public parking lot in Dunedin, Florida, on Friday after a man was seen inside of an SUV exposing himself. End quote. All right, again, this is bad. Really bad. It's awful, right? Totally inappropriate, completely horrendous. And it's about to get even worse. Quote, police say they arrested the 24-year-old and booked him for misdemeanor exposure of sexual organs. End of quote. Now, there are a lot of phrases that you never want your name associated with, but exposure of sexual organs is right near the top of the list. Am I right, Rit? Just kidding. Just kidding, Ike. No, that's not something you want to have an association with your name. And when you combine that with, quote, in a Florida parking lot, there is your exacta. Then again, if you're going to expose your sexual organs, where else would you do it but in a Florida parking lot? An Ohio parking lot, maybe, but most likely Florida. Now, if the story ended right there, it would have been bad enough. There would have been plenty of stupid jokes about how it's a good thing that he's not a relief pitcher, and then we all could have just moved right along. Except the story, of course, does not end right there. TMZ was not going to let that story end right there. They had a lot more leads that they had to track down, a lot more people they had to contact. And a few hours later, they were back with another update, and it got so much worse. TMZ got a hold of the police report, because of course. And it's pretty grim reading. Police, quote, claim in the report, when they got McGuire out of his car, he had, quote, an erection, which was very apparent. End of quote. Listen, I'm really in favor, all in favor of investigative journalism. It is vital to our society and even our country. Except in certain cases, I'm fine with letting certain stories go. I'm fine with letting a sleeping dog lie. There is no need for me to be reading a report that includes the backup catcher getting out of his car with, quote, an erection, which was very apparent. And then to be chasing that with the following, and I quote, according to the report, cops say after they rolled up to the parking lot, they saw McGuire with his shirt, quote, barely covering his genitals, and his sweatpants around his ankles. End of quote. I mean, damn, McGuire. Come on, man. Have some freaking decency or pride or shame or pants or something, man. Anything. And yes, I am aware that he was wearing sweatpants. Just because I did not reference a certain person from a certain town in Southern California does not mean that I didn't notice it. I did. And what McGuire did was so much worse than what Carl had discussed back in the day. And now here is the next line. Quote, cops say McGuire apologized to them profusely for the incident, saying, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. This is really embarrassing. End quote. Embarrassing, you think? Which part, Reese? Oh, I know. Every part. All of it. Bro, I'm embarrassed. I'm humiliated. Man, I'm shamed to hell. I don't want to show my face in public, and I had nothing to do with it. This dude's getting out of the car with, quote, an erection, which was very apparent. Yeah, he's doubling back with, he's getting all MMA ring announcer with it. Excuse me, my bad. My bad, my friend. I'm sorry.
My bad, my friend.
Hey, listen, you know how I always say, be accountable, be responsible, apologize, and mean it? Yeah, except in this case, no credit for apologizing. No credit for apologizing profusely. Listen, America is an extremely forgiving nation, especially of celebrities. But you could be the most popular, most famous person ever, and there are still certain things that you cannot apologize for, and this is one of them. Apology not accepted, Reese. In fact, apology completely rejected, Reese. You cannot be sitting in a Florida parking lot with your sweats around your ankles and say, oh, my bad. Excuse me, my bad. That's on me.
My bad. I called it wrong.
And act like we're all just going to move on with our lives. No credit for holding up your hand on that one and owning it and apologizing for it. According to the cops, McGuire added, quote, I really shouldn't have been doing that. Yeah, finally, something we can agree upon. Reese, you should not have been doing that. You should have been at the team facility working on your game and not in some random parking lot rubbing it out. And incredibly, there is more. It got even worse because of course it did. We're not even done with this. There's more. Quote, in the report, cops claim when they got to McGuire's phone to try to find his current address, they noticed a, quote, extremely pornographic video was playing on the screen. End of quote. I have a question. And I know we have cops listening. They could probably help me with this. Why were the cops trying to get this guy's phone to find his current address? Why not ask him? Like, I'm no police officer, but if I roll up on a guy in a parking lot with a shirt barely covering his junk and sweatpants around his ankles with, quote, an erection, which is very apparent, end quote, the last thing I want to do is reach for this guy's phone to find his address. Not unless I'm rocking a hazmat suit. No, I'm just going to ask the guy where he lives. Man, this dude's a piece of work. Watching, quote, extremely pornographic videos. Not pornographic videos, but extremely pornographic videos in a Florida parking lot. Man, that is the work of a straight degenerate. I haven't heard anything this embarrassing or disgraceful taking place in Florida since Bob Kraft got busted for visiting that alleged sex worker in that strip mall. However, police did say that McGuire was, quote, cooperative and did not deny the allegations, end quote. So you got that going for you, Reese, which is nice. No, it's not. He didn't deny the allegations. Deny the allegations. My guy had a raging erection, extreme porn on his phone, and sweatpants at his ankles. What the hell was he going to say? So again, no credit for being cooperative and for not denying the allegations. How are you going to deny those allegations? Excuse me. It's not what it looks like. Let me explain. Yeah, actually, I'm sure it's exactly what it looks like. And then the topping on this hideous Sunday is the final line in the TMZ update. Quote, officers say they asked Reese why he came to the parking lot instead of just going home. McGuire responded that he, quote, did not know. It just seemed like a good place. End quote. It just seemed like a good place. It just seemed like a good place. Wrong again, McGuire. It's a terrible place. The only place that would have been worse would have been a Boston market. Dude was probably driving around looking for a Boston market, gave up and said, ah, screw it. I can't wait any longer. Next parking lot I see, I'm posting up and getting down. Can't only wait. I can. With extreme porn on my phone and sweatpants at my ankles.
What is X?
the hell is the matter with you anyway, Reese?
Penis man.
Alvin. Wearing those sweatpants, that Blue Jay uniform is a privilege, not a right. I'm guessing you never gave a single thought to the guys who put it on before you, Reese. Now, what the hell am I supposed to say to Joe Carter when I see him? Or Fred McGriff? Or Kelly Gruber? Hell, Robbie Alomar? Should have thought of that, Reese. Should have thought of a lot of things, my guy. If I were you, I would dump that blower that you call a porno theater and just get yourself a flip phone, because this story is going to be all over the internet for the next 1 or 5 million years, and there is no cleaner of any sort that's going to scrub that. Dude, Dave Steeb is very disappointed, and I can't say that I blame him. Dude, I'm never going to be able to look Kelly Gruber in the eye ever again. John Olerud will never take his helmet off now. How do you explain that to John Olerud? Or Ricky Henderson, for that matter. Speaking of Ricky, man, I don't know if that story is true about Ricky saying to John Olerud, hey, man, I once played with a guy who wore his helmet in the field, too. Yeah, Rick, that was me. We were also teammates here. I don't know if that's true. I just always choose to believe it's true. It's an amazing story. Anyway, good luck with that, Reese. When we come back, you see, clones, are you happy? We talked about it. Now, what do you say we just kind of keep moving? I don't think I'm going to go Jim Crane with you. We'll just leave it at that. We'll just leave it at that. Stucknut, I'd hate to be the Blue Jays beat reporter now. Good one, Nut. Kenan essay. Reese is a Blue Jay, but he really wants to be a Yankee. Good one, sports honk. There's about 50 million more where they came from. Mike Krzyzewski. Mike, it is so good to have you back. How are you?
Yeah, great. It's always good to be on, Jim, and I hope everything's going great for you guys out in California.
Super here, Mike. Great to have you back. And although you won't say it, I will say it myself. Today is your birthday, so happy birthday to you. How do you go about celebrating that, Mike? Do you have something special you can do, or do you wait until after the season before you get around to that?
No, we wait, and I just hope to have a good practice today. And, yeah, you get a lot of texts, calls, gifts, cards from so many people that you spend every, you know, a good part of the day trying to answer people, just saying thank you for remembering.
Coach K joining us. I understand that. Now, Saturday night, man, that was some game you had against North Carolina, right? You came down back from 13 in the final 4.5 minutes of regulation. You go to overtime with that game. First of all, Mike, what's it say about the team that you were able even to get that game into overtime on the road against a rival thanks to that missed free throw, rebound, and shot sequence from Trey Jones?
Well, you know, we are fortunate that they missed free throws. And, you know, whenever you make a comeback in basketball, I think the other team has to cooperate. And they had played a great game, but they missed free throws, and so they had some empty possessions. And then we really rode our leader. It was, yeah, I've been fortunate to coach a number of national players through the years, you know, all Americans and these guys, all these top pros. And every once in a while, you're in a game where that person, that player has his moment, not a shot, the game itself or a segment of the game. And that's what happened with Trey Jones. He was on a different level than everybody. He was like the only guy on the court, and the rest of the kids on the team just followed him. And it seemed that everything he did, not just score, but everything he touched turned gold, you know? And he was the reason, you know, there's no question about it. He was the reason.
You know, Mike, he was, and also Wendell Moore. So when you've got guys like the two of them hitting the shots that they hit, and they do it against Carolina, they're going to be remembered for a long, long time. But as the coach, how special is it for you to see them have moments like that, given all the work they put in?
Well, you bring up a great word, and I brought it up too, moments. And I talk to my guys all the time about living in the moment, not in the past or the future, but this moment. And if you live in this moment, sometimes exceptional moments will happen. And that's what happened on Saturday night. It was an epic game. There won't be another one like it. You know, it wasn't a buzzer beater. It was much more than that. I mean, how many times do you see someone intentionally miss a free throw and do it the way Trey did, and it comes back to him, and then he hits a shot. He has a, Wendell, he kept in overtime the ball alive on a missed free throw, and 5 seconds later, it was on his hands laying it in. You know, I mean, just some crazy things. You know, just crazy things. But to be like, I'm 73 years old. For me to be sharing a moment with those kids who are like Wendell's 18. Trey is 20. You know, like that's what a gift I've had, you know, in coaching.
Mike Krzyzewski is joining us. You know, Mike, listening to the way you're laying that out right now and watching you and that team from the outside and looking in, it seems pretty apparent how much you love this team. What is it about this group that you love so much?
Well, there's no ceiling on anyone. You know, sometimes I do love my team. I said from the start of this, you know, start of practice, this will be an old-fashioned team because anybody can help, you know. And so we really don't have a starting five. We've started so many different lineups, and so no one thinks of themselves as the fifth man, the third man, the second power forward, or whatever. They're all themselves, and each of them has, like, and have helped, You know, Trey's been the most consistent along with Vernon Carey. But, you know, no one thinks of himself as a part-time player. And sometimes when you have exceptional players, not sometimes, all the time, you are always trying to complement those one or two guys. Like, and so you put a ceiling on yourself because you're always trying to complement. For us, we just tell them when you go in, be yourself and keep trying to be a better you. And as a result, every kid on the team has contributed to our wins.
Talking to Coach K, you know, Mike, we've talked about Trey, we've talked about Wendell. There's a lot of other individual players I could ask you about, but I do want to ask you about Michael Severino, your grandson. He's on the team. How much does it mean to you to have him as a part of the program? And what's it say that he could have gone someplace else to play, but he was able to get into Duke and he wanted to take this challenge on?
Yeah, and actually, Michael's a freshman. He's my second oldest grandson. We have 10 grandkids, 6 boys, 4 girls. And, you know, Michael was, we're actually redshirting him, he and one of our other walk-ons, because I'd like to see him not just graduate from Duke, but go to graduate school here. And so that's why he's not been in a game. Otherwise, I would be getting a lot of a hard time from not just his mother, but his grandmother. And I live with the grandmother, so I don't want to have a hard time with that. But what was cool, it's cool having him there. And he's not allowed to call me, my grandkids call me Poppy. So in July, when he was coming to summer school, and we sat down, I said, you know, no Poppy stuff. And so he calls me Coach all the time. And when we won, he was the first guy on the court with Wendell, you know, to watch that footage. And, you know, I'm very proud, Poppy for that kid.
That's super. Mike Krzyzewski joining us. You know, Mike, I had your guy, Steve Wojciechowski, on the program last week, and we ended up talking about Kobe Bryant and his team.
Yeah.
His time with USA Basketball. Kobe, of course, was one of your players. So I can only imagine how challenging and how difficult the last few weeks have been for you as a result of his passing. Can you share a thought or two about Kobe? Like, what was he like as a player and a leader for USA Basketball?
Yeah, actually, we had a pretty emotional moment with my team. I hardly ever bring him up to my upstairs office. It's like a museum. And I brought out pictures of the two Olympic teams that Kobe was on and was our leader, and also some individual shots with the two of us. And I said, you know, I lost one of my players, and you guys are my players. And for them, he's the Michael Jordan for these kids. You know, Cassius Stanley, who's from L.A., you know, was heartbroken. And so there were a lot of tears shed. And for me, he was the key guy to build culture for the U.S. team, because he was the best player in the world in 2007, 2008, when we started to build a culture. And his relationship with that next era of stars, LeBron, Carmelo, Chris Paul, Bosh, you know, all those guys, Dwayne Wade, was the key ingredient. And the friendship that he and LeBron developed really was the cornerstone, the foundation upon which we built. And, you know, like, for me, the best thing that a player can do for me is let me in. You know, let me inside of you. And Kobe allowed me to do that. And, you know, I loved him. And he loved my family. Like, he was close to my wife. And, you know, I always had my grandkids at the Olympics. And he treated them. I have pictures of Gigi and one of my grandsons with Kobe and the gold medal. And, you know, the grandson we're talking about, Michael Severino, he so admired him from the Olympics in 2008 that he started calling himself Mamba. And we call him, goofing around, Mamba. And he, you know, that's how close our family. And look, I'm one of maybe, you know, it seems like millions of people who Kobe had that impact on. And certainly in your community, I can't even imagine how heartbroken, how many people were heartbroken there, including the families. I mean, from all nine people, what a horrific event. And it's so tragic and shocking.
No, Mike, you're so right when you say that, because here in the community, because he lived not far from where I broadcast from even, and you're so right, it was such a tragedy for all the families involved. But Kobe was just such a constant presence in the community. Like, people would see Kobe around, and he, as you know, he was so good in dealing with people. This was not a hard person to see. He was always out and about. He was at the kids' games, and that's what makes the whole thing just so shocking. You know, really quickly, I've got about 60 seconds. You mentioned LeBron. What about that dynamic? What was their relationship like, Kobe and LeBron?
Well, I had actually flown up to Akron in 2007 because we only had young guys on our team, and I met with LeBron and before the qualifying tournament. I said, we're going to add three veterans, Jason Kidd, Chauncey Billups, and Kobe. And how do you feel about it? And specifically about Kobe, he says, Coach, that'd be great. He prepares better than anybody. You know, I'll learn from being with him. And really, they were, you know, they both have an incredible sense of humor and so smart. And LeBron would mimic Kobe a lot with the team and privately and laugh. And Kobe would just break down laughing. And to see those two guys interact like that made it so good for everyone else. And I'm sure LeBron is heartbroken for what happened to his friend and teammate.
Alex Rodriguez is weird, man. He is a weird dude. Weird dude. Weird is generally good, except not in his case. He's just weird. We're talking about a guy who went from having a first ballot Hall of Fame career to somebody who'll probably get locked out of Cooperstown for the rest of his life for rampant cheating and lying. Like, if you were going to have something like Mount Roydmore, his face would be carved right into the mountain in the one hole. A guy more famous for making out with himself in the mirror than for hitting nearly 700 bombs. If I were to ask most people, I'm going to drop something on you and you give me a reaction, first thing pops into mind, Alex Rodriguez, he made out with himself in a mirror. I'd get that response way more than I would, oh, he had like 700 home runs, right? So a guy who served baseball's longest suspension ever at that time, but somehow managed to parlay that into two gigs with two major networks to broadcast their biggest games of the year. That guy? This is a guy who just continues to go on and on and on and do and say really weird things. A guy who recently used that platform that I just mentioned and an open mic to tell every parent listening that their kids probably were going to die before they themselves were.
This is the first generation of kids that will not outlive their parents. And to think that there's more kids today playing esports than physical sports, it's something as parents we have to really promote going outside and playing. Maddie, when we grew up, there was not, I mean, it was Atari, but you had to go outside and play for 4 or 5 hours. Kids today, too many times, choose to stay inside and play video games.
Yeah, I don't know, Alex. Like, I've got a kid who does go outside. He plays baseball. He plays high school baseball, but he does get on that PS4. I'm pretty well convinced that Logan's going to outlive me. I mean, but then again, nothing about Alex Rodriguez is normal. He's gone from the poster boy of the steroid era to the poster boy of the Instagram boyfriend era as J-Lo's personal photog. This guy's always standing off to the side at the red carpet, snapping cell phone pics. And trust me, he's better at that than he is at calling games.
I just love the bunt here. I love getting him over to third base, making the game 3-1. You always want even leads versus odd leads. Why? The solo home run doesn't tie it, and the grand slam does not beat you. Keep it simple.
I love when guys think they say something really, really smart like that. That makes no sense whatsoever. Like, no matter what this guy does or says, he continues to pop up in high-profile places, even after saying things like that. And then this week was no different. After predictably inserting himself all over Fox's Super Bowl coverage last week, A-Rod found himself on the other coast, out here at Riviera Country Club, to play in the Celebrity Cup event before the Standard Pro-Am. Rich guys, golfing is a tradition as old as time itself. But rich guys showing up with the set of sticks that Alex Rodriguez showed up with at Riv is something nobody has ever seen before and likely will never see ever again. Thanks to Golf.com's Jonathan Wall, pictures have surfaced of A-Bag's bag. And you don't have to be a golf equipment junkie to understand just how mind-meltingly weird his collection of bats is. Equipment in golf is sort of like a sneaker obsession in basketball. Everybody wants to know what everybody has. So a big part of the golf industry is what's in the bag. What's in the bag? You see the show, you see the segments, you see the articles. What's in the bag? Normally these articles or segments are reserved for tour pros because the general public wants to know what guys like Brooks and Rory are hitting because the general public can head down to the local golf superstore and light their money on fire by buying the same types of clubs that never end up helping them at all. They don't play any better, but you want to swing the same bat that Rory does. It's a really lucrative deal for the manufacturer. But A-Rod got the what's in the bag treatment this week, and it might be the most insane thing that any golfer has ever seen or heard of. Why don't we start with the fact that it's only legal to carry 14 clubs? Of course, he showed up with 16. Because of course he did. Because of course A-Rod would be in violation of some well-known rule before he even got out of the car. Once a cheater, always a cheater. Of course he's going to cheat at golf. He cheated at baseball, and he was going to be the greatest baseball player ever. So, you're not only going to cheat in certain aspects of your life. When you're that rampant a cheater, you will cheat at everything. So far, so bad. He cheats at golf. And in golf, cheating is the worst thing ever. Then there was his driver, a Callaway Big Bertha ERC2. Sounds fancy, right? It is. Or it was back in 2000 when they released it. Dude had a 20-year-old big stick in his bag that now sells used for $7 online right now. And he had it protected with a non-matching head cover. The guy made $527 million on two contracts, and he showed up to Riv with a $7 driver. Maybe he loves the club. Like, some golfers can't move away from a stick that they've had a lot of success with. But there's no way he loves that club as much as he loves four irons. Because, ladies and gentlemen, Alex Rodriguez carries four irons in his bag. Not one, not two, not three, four irons. Find me even one person anywhere who carries duplicate clubs. Find me anybody, and I will show you A-Rod, who showed up with four irons, and one of them was a women's four iron. And we're not even close to done. His eight iron was still shrink-wrapped in protective plastic. So that's weird. Most dudes want to hit the ball on the face off the grooves. A-Rod apparently wants to hit the ball off a bunch of taped up, jagged plastic. There's more. His putter head was molded to the shape of a baseball bat. Of all the things wrong with this guy's setup, this one makes the most sense, I guess. But still, that putter is an abomination to flat sticks, and it has zero sweet spot or forgiveness. And it's a baseball bat with his name engraved on it. Look, if you don't know golf equipment, most players will carry a uniform set of irons and hybrids. Your driver can be any brand. Same with your putter and the wedges. On average, you'll have 3 to 4 different brands represented in your bag. That's not unusual. A-Rod had 7. The word hodgepodge does not begin to do that justice. And again, one was a women's club. And he was carrying 2 more sticks than he's allowed. In his 10 years of covering golf equipment, Jonathan Wall called A-Rod's bag, quote, "the most shocking thing I've ever seen," end quote. Right. Because here, this guy went to 7 different garage sales on his way to Riv, or he ran into a Goodwill and just started picking 20-year-old clubs at random, one of which was still shrink-wrapped and one that was meant for the women's game. Be like showing up to a prestigious pickup basketball game with a bunch of NBA stars wearing a Nike on one foot and an Adidas on the other foot, and both from the year 2000. And bringing a basketball still in the cardboard box from Target that you bought 20 years ago and trying to dribble it in the box up and down. Or showing up to a football game with 4 different sets of shoulder pads for no reason at all and a mixed match uniform. Or going to a celebrity baseball event with a woman's softball bat. Only A-Rod would roll into Riv with that kind of a setup. 16 clubs, 7 different brands, a heinously stupid putter, a shrink-wrapped 8, the wrong head cover for his 20-year-old $7 driver, 4 irons, and a ladies' club. Bro, this is Riviera in Pacific Palisades, not Riverview in Santa Ana. Come on, man. Bag? Bob Myers is my guest. Bob, it is so good to have you back. How are you, Bob?
Good, man. How are you?
Bob, I'm great. In fact, let me rephrase the question. Before we get to the season and the recent moves, I know you had hip surgery recently. How is the hip, and how is life in general?
Life's fine, man. It's good. You know, you can answer that a lot of different ways, but overall good. And the hip's okay. It's just been a long road. I won't bore the listeners, but take care of yourselves. People that are listening, listen to your body. I'm paying for a past debt. I'm paying off old debts because I pounded it out for a while. I played basketball, and then I just kept playing when I was on like the rec circuit. So I played for a lot of years. Then at about 42, my body told me that I was time to pay the price. So, but I'm doing all right, man. I'm doing well.
No, I appreciate that. I think I know where you're going with that answer too, Bob. But the point about listening to your body, I think, is key for sure. All right, so we reached the All-Star break, and like most parts of the season so far, it seems like it's got a different feel for the team this year. We touched on this a little bit earlier in the season, but you knew this was going to be a different season. What's this season been like for you personally?
Kind of eye-opening in that I probably learned more this year. Not it's maybe hard for people to understand that, but when you lose, like we're losing, or I guess lose anything, I think it forces you to examine your process, and you have to kind of look a little deeper. I think I maybe said this to you, but when you win, I heard some other athletes say this, when you win at the level we won, you forget to sweep the corners, you know, so we're sweeping the corners right now because it's about how do we get the young play. Everything we're doing organizationally is in response to kind of, okay, we've had a chance to kind of look in the mirror here, and winning covers up a lot. In anything, success, winning, it covers up a lot. And so when you're winning at the degree we won, everything is fine. I mean, I think overall our core and our foundation was good then, is good now. But in the state we're in now, you really have to kind of examine it all, open up those closets where you jammed everything into them, and have time to kind of pull it all out and look at it. But it's been good. I mean, Kerr's a great partner in this. Our players, I talked to Steph this morning and Draymond. We're good. I mean, we're good. Our health, our mental health, our core, our culture is good. Just we haven't won many games, man. We haven't won many games.
Bob Myers joining us. You answered my question. I was going to say, what about Steve Kerr and your players and how they responded, but you did answer that. Now, you ultimately traded a number of rotational players, including D'Angelo Russell. You could have waited. You could have traded him later, or you could have just kept him. What was it about that deal with Minnesota that made you feel like this was the right time to make that deal?
Yeah, man. There's never a certain – there's no you could shake your magic eight ball on some of this stuff, but you don't know, right? You make the best decision you can with the information you have. And for us, with D'Angelo, you know, he plays a position where we have Steph Curry. And so it was always going to be somewhat of a challenge for one of those two to adapt. We didn't have much time to see how that would go. But we needed a small forward. You know, and for us, you know, Wiggins has got a lot of talent. We felt like in our system, he could maybe grow as a player. And evolve into more than he's been. A guy that talented, you'd like to bet on. We did. I mean, heard good things about his character. The idea of the timing, you don't know. You never will know. But for us, him, getting Andrew, the combination of the pick, getting out of the tax in totality made sense for us at the time. So that was the thinking behind it, Jim. But I'm not so arrogant to think that there's only one way to do things. But this was the decision we thought was the best, and it does give us some time. I mean, Steve said repeatedly, our coach, that having these 30 games with Andrew gives us a head start into next season. And we're going to have so much. I mean, people think with Steph and Clay come back, it's all going to be back like it was. There's a lot of work to do. I mean, we have a tremendous amount of work. Those guys have to find their rhythm again after being out for so long. We have to integrate a lot of new players. Obviously, the West is not getting any easier. We moved into a new building this year. So it's a lot of change. And so having Andrew for this runway that we have at the end of this year, I think will help us kind of adapt as we move forward.
It seems to me, Bob, he's still just 24, and you look at anybody at 24 and where they might be a few years after that, they're going to grow, they're going to evolve. You get a chance to put them in your system and your culture. I think that really bears watching. I think this would be really interesting. You know, I spoke to Coach K earlier in the program today. We talked about Kobe, and there's this story from back in the day when you went to meet with Arne Tellem, and Kobe was a client, and he was there. Can you share that? How old was Kobe at that time, and what do you remember, Bob, about that conversation with him?
The guy was just, you know, he was a presence. You know, I walked in, I remember, you know, there's certain things you remember in your life. I walked in, I remember what chair he was sitting in, because I was brand new. I was I'd finished at UCLA, and I was trying to figure out what to do with my life, and I had a chance to meet with Arne. Didn't really want to be an agent, but was kind of like, let's see what this looks like. And he's sitting there, and he had a Joe Montana retro jersey on. Remember the era where everybody was wearing those the retro jerseys?
I do.
You know, that was the heyday of that deal. It was early 2000s, I think, or late 90s. And he had this kind of irrational confidence that upon meeting him for the first time, you kind of shake your head and laugh. Because he told me he was going to win 10 championships and go move over to Italy, and he spoke Italian, and he had raised there a lot. And I kind of laughed and, sure, you know, good luck. But he'd kind of challenge you on that. He'd say, what do you mean? You don't think I can do that? And you'd say, no, I'm sure you've. He said, I'm going to do it. So he was constantly seeking out competition. Reminds me a little bit of Draymond, where these guys, they have to be seeking out, even in a conversation. I mean, and so the better stories are when he was at that time sponsored by Adidas, and he was doing a commercial shoot, and he said, do you want to be an extra in my commercial playing basketball? And I said, I had no money, I was young, and I said, yeah, I'll do it. We were in LA, and so I was studying today, actually a better story. We were playing horse, because there's two stories, but I'll give you the better one.
Sure.
He said, you want to play horse? And I said, fine, I'll play horse. And I mean, you've been around a lot of famous people, so to speak. You've interviewed them, you probably know a lot of them. And I'm not a special, but once you're around people that are listening, they're just people. Right. Let me just start there. He was an unbelievable person as far as his magnitude and his presence. And I would say this about a lot of so-called famous people, but they're people, right? Which doesn't make them bad or good. They're just people. So he says, "You want to play horse?" I said, "Yeah, I'll play horse with you." So I was actually winning the game, HORSE. So he had HORS, and I had like HO. And if you've been on a commercial shoot, you know how much money they spend every second with the crew.
Right.
So they'd set up this crane where he was going to be dunking and like standing in this little kind of crane, and they had to do a still shot or a still video of him in the air, you know, kind of with his face. They'd zoom in on his face, and he was dunking. So they had it all set up, and they said, Kobe, we're ready for you. And I said, I looked at Kobe, and I said, hey, man, you got to go. I won this game. Like, go ahead. It's over. Like, I had a chore. And he looks down at the director. He says, I'm not coming yet. I got to finish this game. And I said, and so it got a little awkward because the director's like, hey, everybody's waiting for him on the set. And he says, I'm not coming until I finish this horse game.
You know it.
So then the director kind of called. He's like, can you wrap it up? And I said, I can stop right now. I don't need to play this game. You know, you can take him. But then Kobe yelled, you know, he's a pretty demanding guy. He goes, we're finishing this game. I said, all right. So, of course, you know, I lose. Of course, he's I'm not going to beat the guy. He comes back and beats me. But I got to tell you, like, I knew him when he was younger. So there was a time when he was young, like 19, 20, 21, where he didn't. I took him around UCLA a little bit because he didn't. He was very. And people think these NBA players and athletes at 19, 20. It's hard for people to relate to them. They don't have 50 friends. They're not at a big company where they're all going to drink beers on Friday night and then Monday they go back to work. That's not their life. So took him around UCLA because he didn't go to college too. I mean, people. That's a big experience he missed. I said, all right, I'll take you around. And then he became, you know, obviously comfortable and established in L.A., and then I kind of reconnected with him later in life. And he softened. The truth is, I don't know if you, how well you knew him, Jim, but I liked who he was. It's not that I didn't, but when he's as competitive as he is or was in his playing days, I mean, this guy was, he was just a mercenary. He had to win, and he did win. And then at the end of his career, you saw him kind of becoming an ambassador, and obviously the things. I have three daughters; he's got four. I talked to him about daughters, and what he was doing with his daughters. I was probably more impressed, as impressive as he was as a basketball player, which is one of the best ever to play. Watching him further women's sports, watching him be a dad, watching him look to me be at peace. That was the hardest thing for me to process as I heard the news. It was almost like he had just hit his stride in life. Like he, you know, because when you're competing at the level he was, that you have to carry that angst with you, and I feel like he was letting go of that. I don't know what Coach K said about him or whatever, but there's so many accolades. The guy, I mean, the best way to say it is there'll never be another person like him.
Let's get some phone calls in quickly. Virginia, Mike, good to have you. Mike, how are you?
Well, Jim, I guess you could say catcher Reese McGuire wanted to show you his balls.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Boy, Alvin, you kind of panicked, but that's all right. It probably was not going to get any better. Alvin's like hovering over that button. Like I said, I used the analogy the other day, like no whammies. Stop! Well, Jim, Reese wanted to show you. Stop! You got him, Alvin. Way to go, Alvin. All right, anyway, let's try it again. I thought we were going to have a good phone call day when I said we had 13 phone calls all lined up. Let's try Deer City, Michigan. Ray. Nice to have you. Ray, how are you?
How you doing, Jim? It's not Ray, it's Lee, but that's all right.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
All right, guys. Alvin, I think I know the answer, but we had his name wrong. So why did we run him? And I think I know what you're going to say, but what do you have to say for yourself? Wow. Hey, Hawk, why don't you put on your headphones so you and I can have a little chat? Adam, the hell is going on the other side of the glass? I can't do both at once. I can't both host the show and screen the calls and run the board. The hell is going on the other side of the glass, Adam?
Alvin and I are not on the same page right now. That's our fault, obviously.
At all.
That, what happened to Lee in Deer City is my fault. I heard Ray. I put him in as Ray.
I could see where you would. That sounds exactly the same, Lee and Ray.
It's not that easy to hear. There's a lot of stuff going on. I gave him the wrong one-syllable name. He should not have been hammered for that. That's on me. He had a good phone call, too. So I'm upset about that. Also, the guy that called right before had a punchline that I desperately wanted to hear about Reese McGuire wanting to show you his you-know-what and his you-know-what. And so I'm a little disappointed about that as well.
So maybe you have that conversation with Alvin and you kind of tip him off to, Alvin, this is where this guy is going to go. Let him say what he's going to say. Did you have that conversation with the guy to the side of you?
Yes.
Really? What do you have to say for yourself, Alvin? Come on over. Why don't you two switch spots for a minute? There's Alvin. Alvin's on camera, on microphone.
Hey, Jim.
Hello, Alvin. So what do you have to say for yourself?
So I did know the punchline, knew what was coming, but mechanically the caller failed. I could replay it if you want.
Explain to me how the caller failed mechanically. What does that even mean?
So he just left balls hanging for way too long. That's all it was. Can I replay it?
Oh, no, you've done enough. You've done quite enough, Alvin.
He said balls.
You know, I got
one 1,000, two 1,000, three, and then I had to hit him.
Good job, Alvin. Thank you for doing your job. And as far as Ray in Deer City says, actually, Jim, it's Lee. And then you hammered him, and I said, I think I know the reason for that is, quote, don't correct the host. It's okay to correct the host. I'm wrong sometimes. I know you have my back, Alvin. But if I get a guy's name wrong, he's more than in the right to correct me. Like if somebody were to say to you, Alvin, if you showed up the DMV and somebody said, hey, Albert DeLauro, would you not say anything? Or would you say, actually, my name's Alvin? Quote, Alvin said, radio time is very precious. So no, we're not going to have that correction. And you, Hawk, you were so distraught. What was that guy going to say that was so important that he did not get to say that made you so unhappy?
Lee in Deer City, he was going to threaten.
Ray, according to you, but yeah.
Ray, Lee, doesn't matter. I was all about the content. He was going to threaten to drive across Michigan and kick Jeff in Southfield's ass, which I was all about. Little threatened violence. Never hurt anybody.
Like meet you in Temecula?
Like meet you in Temecula. Like meet you in Southfield. So I really wanted Ray to threaten Jeff because that would probably incite Jeff to call back. And then we get a new thread going and I'm all about
that.
Well,
if you really wanted that, then you should have got that guy's name right. Or Alvin would not have run him before he could say what you wanted him to say because you weren't listening and got his name wrong.
A lot of times these callers will call on connections that aren't the best. And I heard Lee instead of Ray. I apologize to...
In other words, you're not accountable, are you, Jim Crane?
Good night now!